Light Pollution News, Episode 3, Like a Sun. This month, I'm joined by youth advocate Bonnie Pang and conservationist and avid bird enthusiast, you know her, Caitlin Evans. We take a look at some of the most interesting articles to grace the topic of light pollution. Today, we learn about the first African-American astronomer. Take a ride on a stargazer train, complete with a glass of wine and a heated flatbread rail car. And MSG wants to build a giant glowing orb, maybe in your neighborhood. As a reminder, find this podcast show notes with news articles and much more over at our website, lightpollutionnews.com. Hi there, you at home. Welcome to another episode of Light Pollution News Podcast. As a reminder, you can learn all about these articles we're going to discuss and more by going to our website at lightpollutionnews.com. Be sure to join our Reddit, r Light Pollution News. Today, I'm joined by youth advocate Bonnie Pang and by conservationist and avid bird watcher, Caitlin Evans. Ladies, welcome to the Light Pollution News Podcast, the show where we shed light only where it's needed. Each month, we discuss articles related to light pollution. Welcome, Bonnie. Welcome, Caitlin. How are you guys doing?
Hey, everyone. My name's Bonnie Pang, and I'm currently a junior in high school at Mainland Regional down in South Jersey. I'm super excited to be co-hosting this podcast, bring you guys some perspectives and opinions from the youth, especially on the issue of light pollution. And I can't wait to start.
Awesome. We're glad to have you, Bonnie.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for joining us, Bonnie. Glad you could have you and glad to have the youth perspective as well on our podcast. Be great to hear your insights.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to kick it off today with this is a doozy. We'll kick it off here. Like a sun on Earth. Las Vegas warning if dazzling venue bill in East End. It will be like a sun on Earth. This is by Miranda Bryant of The Guardian. Per the article, East London residents are being warned that light pollution from a huge new concert venue will be like a sun on Earth. The London Legacy Development Corporation approved plans for a new advertising display covering the outside of a gigantic sphere. The MSG sphere will utilize more than 1 million LEDs to show advertising all night long. MSG Sphere, a duplicate of one that is currently being built and close to completion in Las Vegas, is brought to you by the very same folks who own the New York Knicks and New York Rangers, and I might add that recently used facial recognition technology to ban employees of law firms who are handling cases against the MSG entity from entering Madison Square Garden. Currently, MSG is close to completing their Las Vegas sphere. The Las Vegas sphere sits about 360 feet, that's 112 meters high, and 516 feet wide, so 157 meters wide. MSG plans to seat upwards of 20,000 people in their take on a revolutionary new concert experience. In January, MSG tested their Vegas sphere, which, judging by pictures, looks astoundingly bright. Perhaps one of the brightest things humanity's ever created. One Vegas neighbor compared the recent LED test to like a building a sun on Earth. MSG hopes to provide a new immersive concert experience, having U2 slated to open the Vegas Sphere this coming fall. By all accounts, it appears that this sphere in both Vegas and London's incarnation is a new untenable assault on a night sky, not to mention ecology, energy production, climate change, just to name a few. The current plan appears to be something akin to the Vegas sphere inside a residential area of London, flying in the face of all sensible urban planning. To soften the unabated assault on the nighttime environment, MSG added that they would limit brightness at different times of the day compared to the Vegas sphere, which I assume will be lit up like a star all night long. That is terrifying, at least in my mind. What are your thoughts there, ladies?
So you're saying they're going to basically plant a whole sphere that's like going to take up a large room and then it's going to be a light sphere?
So what the plan looks to be, it looks to be a, essentially, think about having a moon on Earth. It looks to be a giant globe, a giant globe that's a building, And it's going to, I'm trying to think offhand how many stories it would be, but it's going to be multi-story building. The whole outside.
London one, they compare it to be similar height to Big Ben.
There you go.
So I don't know exactly how tall that is, but.
The whole outside is all LED screens.
Why? I mean, honestly.
That's a great question.
I get the hype. Like, I actually showed my friends this article, and then I was like, oh, what do you, how do you feel about this? And then they were like, wow, that's inspirational. Makes me motivated. That looks really energetic and like vibrant. And I'm like, any other thoughts? They're like, it looks like I want to party there or something like that. And I'm just like, okay. Well, that's our perspective, from like, you know, teenagers like us, we love bright things.
Is that what the allure is, Bonnie? Is it the brighter the better?
I mean, I guess so. But this problem, I think, is like really similar to like the casino lighting situation down here in South Jersey. Like, if you ever been down here, you know, like how they love lights and stuff like that. And like, it's understandable that these bright lights are like lively and like attract tourists from all over the place. However, in cities like, you know, Atlantic City, where the casinos are just, the light just never turns off. Like, it's day and night. Someone actually living across town in a fairly rural area, probably like 35 miles away from the casinos, they told me that you can even see the casinos lighting from across the ocean at nighttime, which I think is like crazy. Wow. Like, can you imagine living that far and all you can see on the other side is like a fog of light that comes from the casinos at night? Like, as someone that lives in New Jersey, like growing up here, I've seen this all throughout my life. And like, yeah, going back to the article, I do think the cities just love their lights, which especially has a detrimental effect on the growing issue of light pollution and its effect on like urban suburban areas where I live. And I can only imagine like the amount of carbon dioxide emissions going into the atmosphere. Also in like city areas, you just don't get much exposure to great air quality. So this is definitely like another linking reason, which proposes another environmental threat effect, like regarding the air that we breathe. And we like to think like, oh, well, how will this affect my life? Or how will light pollution affect my life? How will this big giant moon thing affect my life? Well, I mean, there's that.
Yeah.
Right. Caitlin. And just thinking about like the energy, you know, it takes to power something like this, you know, these millions of light emitting diodes going 24/7, you know, like that's a huge energy consumption right there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Essentially the whole outside is a TV. It's just a giant TV screen. And I guess, so my question back to you, Bonnie, on that, when I go through cities nowadays, we see decorative lighting, and usually they're in these shapes of acorn lights. And I don't know if you've ever seen them. They look like these, they drop down. They're kind of like these light bulbs that drop down.
Like the streetlights?
Streetlights, yep. Mm-hmm. And everything has to be set to kind of the max lighting. So there's the max lumen. So it's as bright as possible, kind of making a glow effect. As a teenager, is that something that you feel is just kind of naturally alluring? Like, is that something that you feel your friends may think is naturally alluring? Or is this something that you kind of just have always seen? Like, is this something that you kind of grew up with and you didn't know anything prior?
Okay, wait, question. So is the lighting like all day, like all throughout the night, all throughout the morning?
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. They said the light would be on like all day, and they said potentially could vary in intensity like at night. Like, they're hinting at they could take measures to limit the brightness at night, but there's no details as to, you know, how much they would actually limit the brightness.
Okay. I'm going to be honest. Speaking for like other teenagers, they'll definitely not like, they won't think too much about like light pollution when they see it. They're going to be like, oh, light, you know, fun. But like for me, now that I've like recognized that light pollution is a big issue and that this could potentially affect all of us, I'm just like, why? Like, I understand like why it would be there just for like amusement purposes. But like, then again, I don't think it should be going like lit up the entire, like the whole day. I feel like that's just too much energy waste, too much carbon dioxide, unnecessary carbon dioxide emissions going into the atmosphere again. But I mean, I'll make exceptions if it's like around Christmas time, you know, I feel like it makes sense.
Okay. Okay. Do you think if you were to see the picture they have there is a very kind of a fluid concert thing going on the outside of venue, right? The inside of venue, for those of you at home, you might not have seen pictures of this. Bonnie, this is probably you're probably not going to know what I'm going to talk about here, but the old timers, if you remember an IMAX, this is kind of a glorified IMAX experience. It looks to be very much like an IMAX experience just for concerts. So augmented reality type IMAX type experience. It looks to be really cool inside. I got to give it to them. On the outside, what do you think about the, do you think that level should have definite exceptions? Say like Christmas time, we have say from a week before or 3 weeks before Christmas all the way down to like the week after Christmas. Should that be as Christmassy bright as possible? Or should there be exceptions for like bird migration season, say in the spring and the fall, or something like that work? Like what I'm trying to ask is what's the benefit to having it off versus having it on? So we have the climate, right? We have the a climate piece that it has to, right? It has to be using a lot of energy. We're not talking about like changing an LED light bulb. We're talking about a whole building, this multi-story building that's a TV, right? So I'm just curious, what would the trade-off be? What would you expect to see? Would you want it to be dimmed about like 15% in bird migration season, or would you want that to be dimmed all the way down to say 70% reduction? And then around Christmas time, we can crank that up so it makes sure it lasers through everyone's windows.
Okay. First, I like the Christmas idea. I think that's definitely a really playful approach to like the holiday season. And like when you're talking about the bird migration, I don't think like teenagers like us, we care that much about like, you know, like bird migration and stuff like that. We just want to party all day, all night. that's our truth. I don't think they're going to care too much about the environment. So they're going to love the idea of the globe and like the brighter it is, you know?
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair perspective for sure.
I think we've all been there, Bonnie. All right. Going to do a couple of quick hits here. There's a U-turn on plans to change street lighting at night. This one comes to us from the BBC. Initially, South End city leaders planned a cost savings initiative to dim 90% of the city's lights on a revised sliding scale between 11 p.m. and 5 a.m. So what they're saying is that they're going to reduce the city's lights gradually. They already have a program in place and they're actually going to revise that program. However, fearful residents protested, fearing and, of course, citing safety. So the initiative was thwarted. Per the plan, lights would have reduced about 30% between 1 to 5 a.m. But instead, since it's been thwarted, the current plan remains in place where the levels are 30% of their maximum brightness between 2 a.m. and 5 a.m. Second quick hit, do look up. 1,000 streetlights at risk of falling. Wellington tells residents. Tess McClure from The Guardian brings us this story. Have you ever wondered what it's like to have a bulk sack of rice fall on you? It's probably not pretty. Maybe a microwave? You guys ever consider that one? Well, this is your chance. Apparently, hundreds of streetlights have begun dropping without warning. Lamp heads weigh about 33 pounds, 15 kilograms. Richard McLean of Wellington City Council warned residents of this deadly danger. So a reminder, keep your heads up, folks. You never know. That is a scary proposition.
Okay, wait. This article, that was very interesting. Like, I'll be honest, I have never thought of this. Like, I've never heard of this problem. Like, I don't think I ever seen it happen before, but it's funny because if I told my physics teacher this problem, he'd blame it on the engineering difference. He'd blame it all on the engineer and how like they didn't do the physics or math right, and that's why they're falling. But however, there are like factors that could contribute to this, such as like, you know, weathers, like natural disasters, you know, like temperature changes. So this could also be inevitable. But yeah, I think this issue should be investigated because I do see this being a potential danger. I mean, I wouldn't want to be dumping out my trash in the morning and then waking up in a hospital bed.
Right, I agree. They seem to be treating this very casually for having, you know, a 30-pound streetlight that could be falling and taking people out.
A microwave? That's crazy.
That'll do some damage for sure.
That will do some damage.
Watch out. All right, time to change the tenor away from those depressing stories. Before we get into the main article, I just wanted to touch base with some fun ones. Death Valley. Death Valley's Sky Festival sees the largest attendance in 13-year history. Martha Cruz of News 3 Vegas. Death Valley celebrated the night this past February, February 10th through the 12th, grossing close to 6,000 visitors over the course of 3 days. Folks were treated to a slew of nighttime activities, including talks, field trips, astrophotography workshops, night sky tours, and more. That's a pretty cool little thing going on out there.
That is really cool. Is it like promoting like astro tourism?
Yeah. Have you ever done any astro tourism?
I have not, but I really want to try doing some.
Well, we have some more good stories on specifically that item coming up in a second.
I'm happy like people are going out of their way to be part of like this experience. Like we definitely need more dark sky awareness in like more dark areas, like the one in Death Valley.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Have you ever seen a Milky Way?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I've seen like photographies of it, but I've never really looked up and seen a Milky Way.
Yeah. And I bet that most people in your class probably just think it's something you can only see in photographs, right?
Or something that you eat. But yeah.
Yeah. It's true. Well, this is a cool little story. There's a children's book. Young readers can take flight with Ollie's Dark Sky Journey.
I think it's Olay, Bill. Sorry to interrupt you.
Olay's Dark Sky Journey.
It's okay.
Scott Iwoski of the Park Record up in Park City, Utah, was following the story of Olay, a Mexican spotted owl. As that makes sense why it's Olay. There we go. As Olay takes you through 18 of Utah and Nevada's state and national parks in search of dark nights. Olay helps kids learn important nighttime sights, including constellations. The book's author, Melissa Marsted, worked with park rangers to help craft this book. So that's a nice little piece if you have any children out there that maybe not you, Pang, or Body, that if you have. But
yeah,
this is a really nice little thing you can get for the young ones out there.
Yeah, I definitely think about getting it for my nephew. He's a little over two, and he's into all kinds of animals. He loves the moon. Seems right up his alley.
I mean, I'll get one for myself. This is like a great opportunity to like immerse kids and like introduce children about like our night sky, because light pollution again is an issue that affects everyone, including children. And you know, there's a whole world out there, or I guess I should say up there, that a lot of kids don't know about. So yeah, I think it's important to expand the audience and for kids to grow up knowing the stars and planets.
Right. And if you don't know what you're missing, why would you bother to try and save it or protect it?
Yeah. Making sure that we do our parts as like advocates and as a teen. I'm glad we're trying to gain more audience from different perspectives, and it's never too late to teach someone about like the stars until of course we can't see them anymore.
Yeah, I can say here in Philly I don't know how many, I haven't counted. I'm not good with doing my star counts, but I would say we're probably in a 25, maybe 30 stars you can see. But that's that's going by the wayside, probably. It's another story. Have a go at astrophotography, zip wires, and walks at night in the Starry Festival. Rachel Rogers of York Mix. This is pretty cool. Check this out. In North York Moors, this is a Bortle, I want to say, 4 or 5 sky in Northern England. Folks put on a full celebration of the night. The Dark Sky Festival went from February 10th to 26th, allowing participants to engage in fun ways with the nighttime environment, including adventure camping, astrophotography workshops, nocturnal animal searches, bat box workshops, sundown zip lines, and there's a lot more. That's a very fun idea. That's pretty cool. I hope they had a great turnout for that.
Yeah, is this like similar to the Death Valley National Park event?
Except for, this seems a lot more fun, honestly.
Yeah, it seems like it has a lot more activities and arts and crafts and a zip line.
Yeah. Hopefully in the future we'd have more of these events near me, you know.
Yeah, something like this. Would this be, you know, I mean, a lot of times I think when you're trying to translate the reasons to protect the night or the reasons to engage with the night, not even protect it, just engage with the night ecology and the stars and everything, it's really mellow. It's not, it's not like a thrill ride. And here they have zip lines, and here they have, you know, you can go out and try and see if you can find, nighttime animals, essentially. That feels like it's in a much more much more fun.
Engaging, too.
Right. For most people, like, right?
Mm-hmm. I could totally see myself making core memory there, like kind of like that family bonding type of event or something.
Yeah, exactly. Family bonding. You guys would be screaming as you go down the zip lines.
Right? I am very adventurous, so...
Next up, this vintage train takes you out to Stargaze near Santa Fe. Erica Mailman of the Timeout. Are you looking for some stateside fun? Well, check this out. If you could take a ride on a Stargazer train and be treated to a guided tour of the night sky by an astronomer with live music and even a complimentary glass of wine, except for Bonnie. Sounds...
Well, aren't you adults lucky?
Someday you'll be there too, Bonnie. Don't worry.
It sounds like a relaxing way to end a long week, right? According to Mailman, the Santa Fe Conservation Trust researchers have determined that a single unshielded street lamp can affect the view of the night sky for an observer upwards of 125 miles away. Maybe London's mayor, Sadiq Khan, could be told that or informed of that, or might have to remember that when he's putting his new Death Star in the residential area up there.
I'm still a minor, so I'm not going to get too excited about the wine part, but I definitely see great benefits in this event for adults. If I were legal age, this would definitely be something on my bucket list, and this is definitely something that I would romanticize. I mean, isn't there like a whole moon that you see on this? And then,
Here you get live music, right? You get live music. Yeah, you get to go on a train.
Yeah, ride. So there's even a flatbed car you go out to observe on with a heated floor, like. Wow. Very luxurious.
Wow. Heated floor in a flatbed car. That sounds fun. All right. Next up, how reading the night sky helped Black Americans survive. And this one is going to be the feature article for the month here. This comes to us from Heather Greenwood Davis of National Geographic. Have you guys ever heard of Benjamin Banneker?
Mm-mm, not okay. Until this.
Well, this is one we probably all should have heard of. I doubt conventional American history or whatever partisan colored history they teach today, and that's not trying to take a side or another, references Banneker. Banneker is the son of a former slave and a son of a former indentured servant. However, he left his mark on history as the first African-American astronomer of notoriety. So he's born in 1730s, and this is during the colonial time. Attended a Quaker school, had a predilection for engineering. He built irrigation solutions for his family farm, built a wooden clock that would keep time accurately until his death. Banneker spent 3 months even helping survey the newly planned Washington, D.C. In the 1790s, following that time, Banneker's notable contribution derived from being the first African-American to produce astronomical calculations used in identifying statistical details of astronomical alignments and tide times. Typically, these would be in a form of 6 almanacs that he made, and they're used by fishermen and farmers and different types of people who rely on such estimates and such predictions to help them take care of their craft. Banneker even advocated for equity and respect by using proof through his almanacs of the dignity that African Americans needed to have. He sent one of them to Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson, who actually forwarded it out to his friends over in France because he was so impressed. So we fast forward to the early 19th century. Constellations blazing bright in unobscure skies helped runaway slaves find the Underground Railroad hideouts. For instance, signal songs like the following, like following the drinking gourd, code for Big Dipper, helped runaways identify their direction by the North Star. So they actually used the stars or constellations as kind of beacons to where you need to go, how you can kind of hopefully safely arrive at a sympathetic household. A truly curious article for how overlooked and important the night sky is on society. For instance, Davis cites how, lacking any formal education, African-American farmers, both free and enslaved, it was imperative to understand the workings of the night sky to gauge planting cycles. This is a pretty interesting article. It's a great article for Black History Month, and it's just a very interesting piece that we don't seem to have much recognition of in our society. Yes, Bonnie.
Yeah. So going back to
sorry, I wasn't trying to hold you back there.
No, I was really eager, but going back to the the invention at the 1790s. What did you say he invented?
So he invented he did a number of inventions on his end. So he built a clock to accurately tell time, which wasn't a shoo-in. You didn't have time devices everywhere. He had to mathematically understand the workings of the sky and predict solar eclipses, which he did in 1788, 89, I believe, somewhere in there. He accurately predicted the timing of solar eclipses. But he would write an almanac. An almanac essentially is just telling people predictions about the timing of the future. So tidal times, if you're down in Atlantic City, you have the high tide, low tide. So he's predicting the tide times. He's predicting when growing season should start and different things like that.
So probably based, moon phases too, I'm guessing?
Yep, based on the moon phases, calculations through the moon phases, calculations of how constellations will move across the sky.
That's around the time of the Industrial Revolution too. But it's crazy how stars can be so impactful. Like in history, astrologers have always looked up to the star for centuries, and that's for a purposeful reason, navigation, which we don't really think about it in this day and age because technology has advanced so much. We just use the GPS or Google nowadays, and we forget that stars are meaningful and a part of history. We shouldn't forget about them and the purpose they once served to guide so many people to freedom.
Yeah, it's kind of you just don't. First off, I was never taught this. But it's so interesting, and it makes so much sense that if, in antebellum America, that this is one of the ways you're able to hopefully navigate, bring slaves out of the South into a household that will be helpful to them and help them get the freedom that they needed.
Yeah, it's really inspirational. Yeah, I like that.
I do too. I agree. Caitlin, you're a little quiet over there. Any thoughts on your end?
No, I think it was really interesting. And just, I'm not an astronomer myself, but I can't even fathom being able to do the calculations required to predict a solar eclipse. That's astounding to me. Very impressive.
Banneker he did go to Quaker school, but a lot of this stuff, he learned a lot of stuff on his own. And it shows you that, and this is 1790s we're talking about. It shows you how, first off, self-initiative, but he was an outspoken advocate for African-Americans, trying to earn African-Americans' dignity. It's a great story, and it's definitely one I'm glad we were able to discuss here. All right, moving on to my favorite segment of the show every month. Afraid of the Dark. It's the Afraid of the Dark segment. Streetlight faults leave residents in the dark. Local Democracy Reporter. This is another article that comes to us from the UK. In the short time this show has been on the air, we've spoken about streetlights quite often, if not pretty much all the time. as this episode where we had an issue with falling lamps or residents rebelling against dimming. In Scotland, 200 faulty streetlights leave residents, and I quote, literally, in the dark. Over the past 2 years, lights in some areas of Edinburgh have been without streetlights. Politicians blame the power supply, this case is Scottish Power, for having multiple faults in their network. And it looks like there's a, when we have a blame game, what happens? Councillor, as in the elected official, Councillor Kevin Lang, asserted proper street lighting is essential for people's safety, particularly for vulnerable people when they're out and about at night. Yes, Bonnie.
Well, I don't think there's like specific or any scientific proof that lighting deters crime, but it definitely has its benefits in making areas feel safer and not, you know, not straight up a horror movie. But this problem, as mentioned previously, has many different approaches and solutions, and like how we can effectively use our light. A better solution, I feel like, would be to have like light motion sensors. Like, you guys have any of those? Because I have one of those in my garage and like in my parking lot as well. So for example, when it senses someone walking past, the motion is being detected at a certain radius from the light source, the light would like shine for a certain amount of time. And I feel like that's just a better use of lighting, even with the falling lamps and like the previous articles of like the dimming lights. I feel like using motion sensors for like more effective light usage is probably a better solution in most cases.
Yeah, it's funny you bring that up, Bonnie. I didn't include it in this article here, but there are companies that are trying to have motion sensor lights set up. So motion sensor street lights, where they would either change the brightness as people come through. So it could detect someone walking along or driving along, it would change the brightness based on that motion, or it would actually just turn on as people are coming through. And with current LEDs, it's really easy to do that. With the old, their sodium lights, the orange glowy ones, they had to be on the whole time, but LEDs don't. LEDs you can turn on, turn off. There's no warm-up time with them. So that's a really good point.
Right, and I can see that the motion sensor, like that could improve safety in multiple ways. You know, safety for, you know, someone walking down the street. Maybe they don't have great vision. Like, you know, it gets brighter when they get closer. So that way you can still have dim lights, but people that maybe have vision issues, they can still feel safe walking down the streets because it will get brighter as they approach. But also in, you know, people who have concerns about crime, you know, if you have street lights lighting up, that kind of highlights that someone's there. So you're more aware of that versus if the street lights are just on all the time.
Mm-hmm. And I think the dimming lights from certain hours in cases, you know, sometimes there will be no potential dangers that like happen that night, and it's just a waste of energy overall. But yeah, I feel like motion sensors kind of eliminate that issue. Yeah. It only effectively goes on.
Wouldn't that be interesting? Wouldn't that be neat? That would be great to test out. It'd be great to see how motion sensors would work in a city environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, another thing I've noticed in these articles is that they never give quotes from residents that might be in favor of having less lighting. Like maybe there's people that had a street light right outside their house and now they're like, I sleep much better without the light. You know, we never hear that side of the things in these articles, which, you know, makes me wonder if there are people that are appreciative of the lower lighting.
Yeah, Caitlin, it's funny you mentioned it. I didn't include an article here because I couldn't get everyone access to the article, but there is an article from Michigan where a homeowner is suing, or a homeowner is claiming that they lost a ton of value on their home because the city put in new lights at a roundabout and the lights have shined in so much that they've taken down the value of their actual home. It's an interesting article. I can forward out to everyone after we conclude here, but to your point, there's an impact, and just, I think we're so conditioned to think it's either bad lighting, and by that I mean just excessive, poorly engineered, as you said, Bonnie, right? Poorly thought out, versus no lighting. And it doesn't have to be that way. It doesn't have to be one or the other. We can come up with better solutions. I love the idea of a motion sensing light. That would be so cool.
I'm actually doing a project on like investigating motion sensors, and like, that's how I kind of came up with that idea.
Well, keep us up to date on your project. I'd love to hear what's going on with that.
I will.
Yeah, that's excellent. And the reason I included this article here for this to be afraid of the dark is specifically for what you said, Caitlin, because it always feels like at the end of the day, politicians want to leverage this people safety thing. And it doesn't necessarily mean anything. They don't have any meaning behind it. They just want to find a way to put a wrench somewhere to kind of pry open outrage against the, to get a policy that they want it to change to what they're kind of getting people on their side. Right.
Mm-hmm. And you see this in a lot, like fear makes the news. If you have something that gets people riled up and afraid, like it gets more attention on the news. It gets more eyes on your article. It seems like.
It definitely does. Definitely does. All right. We're going to wrap it up here. Before I go, Bonnie, thank you for taking some time to come on the show with us. This is excellent to hear a Gen Z perspective.
It's really fun for me, actually. I love like talking and like sharing everyone, like my opinions, hearing everyone else's opinions and just like discussing articles. It's fun.
Yeah, I hope to have you back on.
I would love to come back on.
Caitlin, thank you again for joining me here. Is there anything, Caitlin, you want to say? No, we have in April, we have some migration season coming up. Anything that people should be aware of with, you know, checking out maybe things that they can do at home to kind of help the migration season?
Yes. So usually April will begin a lot of the lights out programs in cities. So that's when cities will dim their lights for, you know, certain hours at night, because the artificial lighting, it does affect bird migration because birds use things like the moon, the stars to navigate. And so they get drawn towards cities with these bright lights. And they can even be drawn towards, you know, like housing areas, like residential areas as well. So during bird migration season, usually like April, May, it's recommended that people turn off their outdoor lights at night. So if you have like a porch light you like to keep on, you just turn that off at night or make sure your lights are shielded and aimed down.
Yeah, there's an exhibit at the Academy of Natural Sciences here in Philadelphia that shows you a whole bunch of different live, or not live, they're different dead specimens of birds that have crashed into buildings during migration season at night. They crashed in because the building's really, really bright and they got confused and they just, it's a sad exhibit, but it's very interesting, very informative. And anyone on, you know, in this area, Bonnie, if you ever come up to mm-hmm. a city, you can definitely check that out. It's a nice mm-hmm. little, it's a cool spot.
What is it called again?
It is. What is the exhibit called? Caitlin, do you know what the
exhibit is? So it's at the Academy of Natural Sciences, and the exhibit is called Conversations with Birds.
I will write that down.
So we have one more article here. Our research article of the month, Artificial Lighting Affects the Landscapes of Fear in a Widely Distributed Shorebird Communications Biology. There are three researchers who I'm now going to go on to definitely butcher their names. Jokohan, Gaston, and Trusianko, and they undertook a study to see how artificial light at night, Alan, affects flight initiation responses of a specific shorebird known as Eurasian curlew, a species that's currently listed under the near threatened designation. Their research asserts that in low-lit areas, such as areas with a forest obscuring light, they also note, I think, moonlight as low-lit areas. So they're talking about really versus direct, say, street lamp, which you have a high level of lumens. The flight responses to perceived predators led the birds to initiate flight from a shorter distance of perceived threat. So the birds will fly away later. It will be more of a last-minute flight departure than if it was a very bright area. Then they would actually kind of fly away earlier. So they'll be able to actually see the predators earlier. Alan might provide more opportunity to reduce the perceived predatory dangers for these birds. For better or worse, Alan has the effect of increasing the rate of disturbance of curlews. Its impact on curlews' foraging behaviors and predator and predation of other animals who are looking to eat the curlews has yet to be studied. So, Bonnie, I see you're over there raising the hand.
So when you say ALIN, is that an acronym for artificial light?
Yes. Yep, night? That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yep, artificial light at night, ALIN.
And that affects the curlews, which are a species of birds?
Yeah, yes. They're a species of shorebird. And so basically what the article is saying that in lower light levels, the perceived threat has to get closer to the curlew before it takes off and flies. But at brighter light levels, the perceived threat can be further from the curlew before it will take off and fly.
So if I'm getting this right, the more artificial light there is at night, the more dangerous it is for the curlews? Or
so it's just, so the brighter it is, the further... the further distance the curlews can perceive a potential threat.
Oh, so it like helps them in a way?
So I guess they're not really sure of the impact. So what they're suggesting is that it's disturbing their foraging behavior more often. So they are flying and moving their foraging location. So it could, one theory is it could potentially negatively impact their foraging behavior. Like they might be getting less food because they're constantly flying because of some potential perceived danger.
Oh, okay. I understand that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Because we're really talking about just an animal change in behavior from artificial light. So it's an environmental change and how that's... I don't know if it's good for us to understand if that's positive or negative, but it is a change. And we don't know enough about the downstream effects. For instance, what about the foxes or whoever preys on these birds? How does that affect them? So light affects the environment. And this is another example of how ecology is affected by having outdoor light.
Yeah, definitely. And we don't really think about like how artificial light also affects other species, like I think they also affect like turtles, I'm pretty sure, snails and like curlews, now that I've learned that.
Yeah. It actually, when you go down to parts of Florida, they'll have dark sky rules for the beach. So that way the sea turtles aren't confused by lighting because they can get really confused. So they have a lot of warm, low level lights, which actually I find add to kind of a nice ambiance at night, because you can go, your eyes are already, they're already starting to get night adapted because it's warmer light. So it's warmer, lower level, your eyes get a little more night adapted. You can see where you're walking because your eyes can actually see at night. Mm-hmm. You can't see colors, but you can definitely make out what you're looking at, especially on a beach. So it's kind of cool. It's kind of cool to, you know, when you have some of these, just to see. Like, we don't think about it, right, Bonnie?
We don't. And, like, it'd be interesting to see an article, like, discuss here an article that, like, involves red light and stuff.
Yeah. Well, we had an article last month on some of the impacts of red light. So if you want to go back, or anyone, if you listening at home, want to go back and actually check that out. And of course, you know, we can, all of our articles are online at lightpollutionnews.com. So you don't even have to listen to a show. You can just go there and check out the articles.
Yeah, I know for sea turtles, for like the coastal lighting ordinances, they do suggest like a warmer, like more red toned light, because that's supposed to help negate the impacts of the light on the sea turtles. I'm not sure like if you're familiar with the impacts of light on sea turtles, but sea turtles lay their eggs on the beach. And so what naturally is supposed to happen is when the sea turtles hatch, they're supposed to be attracted towards the ocean, which is going to be the brightest thing from either the moonlight or the starlight. But when you have the artificial like lights from houses and the streets, they're attracted away from the ocean towards the streets and houses instead of going towards the ocean. So that resulted in a lot of sea turtle deaths, unfortunately.
Yeah, and it just confuses them, I bet.
Yeah.
Well, Bonnie, Caitlin, I want to thank you again for joining me on the Light Pollution News podcast. Look forward to doing this again sometime soon with you guys. For listeners at home, we'll be doing this another month. And until then, you can definitely check out these articles and more at lightpollutionnews.com, or you can go to our Reddit and say hi. We'll have these articles up on the Reddit Light Pollution News. Again, thank you all for listening, and definitely aim the lights down and only use it where it's needed.